everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to be talking about The Self-Made Widow, which I think has this incredibly cool cover. And it's our first time to do an event in the store with Fabian Nicieza. So welcome.
Thank you, Barbara. It's great to be here.
And thank you for coming out this evening, braving the storm, which is now past. So you have an interesting background. Let me just read for a moment from the blurb here. A comic book writer and editor, best known as the co-creator of Marvel's Deadpool, and for his work on titles such as X-Men, X-Force, New Warriors, Cable, and Thunderbolts. Wow. So I've discovered through an earlier conversation that Fabian and I had that he actually started in the book business. His first job out was working for this very publisher back in the days of paperbacks. So I won't embarrass you by asking how long ago that was.
Oh, no, I throw it out there without a problem. I'm pretty proud of my ability to still be alive. I started working at Berkeley Publishing, which was the sister paperback imprint of Putnam Publishing, the hardcover, in 1983 when I graduated college.
Okay.
And I was hired in the production department, which was really kind of the second lowest rung in the company next to the mailroom. No offense to mailroom people, honestly. And the man who hired me had been in the industry a very long time. He passed away, I think about 10, 15 years ago. His name was Ani Reizek. Mm-hmm. And he told me the day he hired me, if you're still doing this job in 6 months, either you suck or I suck. Let's find out which it is. And I thought to myself right then and there, my very first day when he hired me, I you got to keep moving and publishing, you know, or you disappear. So 6 months to the day, basically, I got hired, I was promoted to a job in the managing editorial department, which was like the middle ground. Production had to get the materials from managing editorial and send it out to the printers. And cold typesetters back then, the actual old original metal type, that's how long ago it was. We were just starting to do computer-based typesetting. And I went to managing editorial, which would get the manuscripts from the editors and then funnel them down to production. It's all paperwork, administrative stuff. And I did that. I was there until 85 when I got a job opportunity at Marvel, which again, publishing, you move around a lot in order to increase your salary. So the job at Marvel was going to be offering me like $3,000 more a year than I was making, $14,500 instead of $11,500.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of money when you're 22, 23 years old, 24, and you're living in the Northeast like that. So besides the fact that it was Marvel and I really wanted to work there, it was also a money grab. So I started working at Marvel in August of 1985. In the manufacturing department there, but 4 months into that job, I left. I stabbed the poor woman in the back who hired me, and I left because there was a job opening in the promotion publicity department, which is where I really wanted to go because my major at college was communications, advertising, and public relations, and I wanted to do ad copy for Marvel. So I get to write, but I'm doing advertising work, which I enjoy, for the comics, which I really enjoy. And it actually ended up working out like absolutely perfectly. I became Marvel's advertising manager in late 86, and I did that job for 5 years before moving over to editorial. Again, every few years you gotta recycle yourself a little bit, I think, when you're in a staff job in publishing.
So comics books, you know, were a really big thing for a long time. I remember taking my 25-cent allowance when I was a kid and pedaling up to Woolworths, where they had the comic books in a display. Probably you're all looking at me blankly, so you probably don't even remember this. It was so long ago. It was in the, you know, in the 40s and 50s, and it was a really big thing. There would be like a new Batman or a new Superman or, you know, whatever, and, you know, Wonder Woman and all that great stuff. And so it was basically serial publication. You know, you'd have the comic book and then stories would be continued to the next comic book.
I came to the United States in 1966. I was 4 and a half. My brother was 7. And we recognized Batman and Superman on the newsstand, and literally the little corner kiosk newsstands in New York City and Queens, because that's where we moved to. And we asked our parents if we could get Batman and Superman. We recognized them not from comic books, we recognized them from TV in Argentina. And And we started learning how to read and write English faster, better, because we were reading comic books. The combination of visual graphics with the written word made us understand the language concepts a lot faster. Neither my brother or I mean, I started first grade in the United States, but he was already in like second or third, and he didn't get left back. We picked up on it pretty quick, and became regular readers. Just not psychotic collectors, got a hoard and, you know, have 100 of them. We used part of our allowance for comic books. The other part was all the all-important baseball cards and movies and candy.
I know, all that,
you know,
stuff that, you know, seems so ephemeral there. And, you know, the productions were not meant to last. So your comic books didn't last a lot, baseball cards. But it turned out they're, because of that,
because
the
of
ones that
yeah.
did survive are
yeah.
worth an absolute fortune.
Yeah.
So you could actually plot a crime novel around, like, baseball cards.
Yeah, you could. Easily. Because, I mean, look, original comic book art is a piece of art by an artist, Frank Miller, and the painter who did the color on it, Lynn Varley, just sold for $2.5 million at auction. It was a cover for this famous comic book called The Dark Knight Returns from the 80s.
I remember that. Yeah.
And that cover just sold $2.5 million. And the value of it is through the roof right now, mostly because the Bitcoin rich boys have all decided that's where they want to spend their money for now, you know?
Lots of opportunities for crime novels here. So what brought you from the comic book world back into publishing as an author rather than as a person in production?
In 2017, I had always tried to write prose, and I wasn't happy with what I did. That's really all it amounted to. And the fact that I had paying work on a regular basis of other kinds of writing, whether it be comic books or whether it be intellectual property management for Hollywood studios or video game script rewriting, animation Bible development, I've done all of that kind of stuff. I had tried writing prose and just wasn't happy with it, and excused myself from trying because it wasn't going to pay. Right, so in 2017, the best motivating factors I have in my life tend to be anger and jealousy. So I got really jealous and really angry that I saw several of my peers, not even my contemporaries because they were all younger than me, but peers within my industry selling novels. They had started successfully to write books and sell books, and they varied from paperback, you know, sales they were making to hardcover, and I just said to myself, why the hell are they selling books and I'm not? What am, you know, I'm better than them. I'm not, but you gotta convince yourself you are. So I said, if I don't do it now, when am I gonna do it? I was almost 58 years old, I think. I gotta do it. So I started to write the book that I always wanted to write since I originally had the idea in 1995, and that was Suburban Dicks. And I wrote it on and off all through 2018, sporadically, because it wasn't a paying gig, so it wasn't my regular work. I still had to, you know, pay the bills, so I had to do regular work. So it took me about 14 months to finish the manuscript. And I paid a professional freelance editor to read it and give me notes on what I got to do to improve it. Where do I have to change? Where do I have to cut? And I knew I had to cut a lot because my manuscript was too thick. It was 550 pages, and
Oops.
I knew that
Wow.
was too much. But I didn't know what I didn't know, and I learned. Ellen Lamb is her name. She's a pretty prolific freelance editor for a lot of people. She really helped me in just showing me how to cut, how to take shortcuts that are smart. Don't repeat things to the audience that just because the characters don't know it, you already revealed it to the audience, so don't repeat it again. Things like that. And little by little, I whittled down 50, 75 pages. And through other business contacts, I had an agent at UTA who really loved the idea, the concept. He loved the concept, and he said he'd read the manuscript when it was finished, which, if you don't have an agent, it's really hard to sell the book. So knowing that I at least had someone who would look at it was really helpful. So once I did a first round cut, I gave it to Albert Lee at UTA, United Talent Agency, and he had his whole group of people read it, and they came back and said, "We love this. This is fantastic." And I was like, "Really?" I was like, a couple people had read sporadic chapters, but nobody had read the whole thing except me. And And Ellen. And Ellen had told me that it was really good, but I didn't know for sure, you know? I was paying her to edit the books, you know? She's probably not gonna tell me it stinks. So Albert and his team really loved it, and I learned my next valuable lesson in book publishing, because they said, there's just a few things we'd like to change. And I said, bring it on, let's hear it. I come from the comic book industry. You work in a collaborative team, you know? You have an artist, a letterer, a colorist, an editor, everybody, you know? He came back with notes that needed some things I needed to tweak, some changes to some characters that ended up actually really improving the overall whole of the book. And I cut another 75 pages or so. So now we had it down to 425. And I said, that's it. I can't go lower page count than this without cutting bone. And then I'm just chasing my own tail. If someone's going to buy it, then by all means, let them tell me what else I need to cut. And he took it out to 12 major publishers, and 6 wanted to buy it, which was completely unexpected. And the book went to auction, and between 4 publishers bidding on it, so that turned into a 2-book deal instead of a 1-book deal. It was Putnam and another really, you know, good publishing company, but we ended up going with Putnam. Both offers being equal, we just were more comfortable going with Putnam. And quite frankly, I really did like the story that my first novel is going to be published by the company that first hired me out of college. I liked the story. It felt good. So you know, once Putnam bought it, Mark Tavani is the editor at Putnam. He said, I really like this. Obviously, I wouldn't have wanted to buy it if it was just a few things we need to do. So it's like, okay, great, bring it on, let's do it. We got it down to, I think, about 380, 390, the manuscript, which is the target that I learned that they want to go for. So on this one, I was golden. Once I did it, once I knew what I had to do, I started writing The Self-Made Widow the week after we started shutting everything down with the pandemic. So March of 2020, I went to a comic book convention in Mexico City, La Mole. That's when everything was shutting down. It was like a last gasp. I have this commitment to this convention. I want to go to it. My wife wasn't thrilled that I was going. I was like, come on, we're all going to blow up. It's not like, you know, it's going to take a week or two before we all get this thing. So I came back and we were shut down that Monday. I came back on a Sunday or a Monday and we got shut down. And less than a week later, I started writing The Self-Made Widow. And I was just hiding in a corner of my house, because my wife was there, because the school, she works in a school, and the school went virtual. My daughter is an esthetician, and the Ulta where she does her services, it went on hiatus basically for a few months. My son came home from college because it turned virtual, and they wanted everybody off campus, even though he lived in an apartment. My sister-in-law moved in with us because she had lost her job a few months earlier. So I had 5 adults in the house, and I had to write the book. So it was just a matter of finding the furthest corner of my house that I could hide in to write the book. So most of this was written in a reclining chair in the corner of my bedroom. It's pathetic. There's no illusion of this being glamorous at all. I finished the first draft in November of 2020.
It focused your mind, didn't it?
Yeah. I'm very good when I know I have a deadline, and I know I have it's an assignment to me. I love doing this. I love writing prose now, but it's still an assignment. I was contracted to do this. I'm being paid to do it, but I don't get paid until I hand in the manuscript. So I got to hand in the manuscript. I also didn't. I knew not to overwrite. I knew not to repeat. I knew. I just learned real quickly. I picked up real fast what my shortcuts needed to be to do it right. So I purposefully put things in the book that I knew Mark would want to cut for space. Yeah, Mark knows. I told him. But the two main characters are Andrea Stern and Kenny Lee. There are. They each have 3 flashbacks to their childhood, their teen years, their early adulthood, as a way of reflecting what their family upbringing was, what their parents' marriages were like, as reflective of the themes of marriage in the book. And each of those flashbacks were probably about 6 to 8, 8 to 10 pages long. And I knew that that was more than Mark was going to want in the book, you know. So I knew that each of those flashbacks were going to give me a chance to buy back 4 pages or so, 5 pages per flashback. So when if I hand in a 400-page manuscript, I think this was 405 or something, that those 20 pages or 25 pages are going to get me right where it needed to be. And we did. It did. It worked. I was tricky that way, but I got to cut stuff out of the manuscript that wasn't cutting bone. You know, it was just, you know, trimming
so a little
wall on the edges.
So when you're talking about this ideal count, what is that based? Is this research about how long readers will stay with the story? Is this a production value? I can digress into Agatha Christie, and I'll tell you about that in a moment.
I asked out of curiosity, and I just accepted the answer, which is that it's a combination of multiple reasons. One of which is the audience preferences and audience expectations. The other is the amount of paper that they got to pay for, because paper costs money and print time and press time costs money. So it reduces the cost of production.
Right.
Dramatically, because it's also dealing with the cover and the spine size and all of these other little things that all start to add up. And it lets them put the book out at the price point that works for them, and hopefully it works well enough for the reader. I know all the readers would like it for free, but so that's really the reason. I feel as a writer that I've noticed over many decades that that the attention span of all of us is shrinking. We want things faster. We want our entertainment content quicker. So you look at a TV show today versus a TV show in the 1980s, and you think that like they were growing redwood trees with the pace that they were doing their stuff back then, you know, on television and in film. And nowadays everything is faster. The editing is faster. The camera movement is quicker. The dialogue is faster. Everything. Books are kind of the same way. I think you get less massive volumes now than you used to.
Well, actually, I think it's the opposite is true. I think that books have gone up in size, quite a few of them. We used to get lots of crime novels that came in 280 pages, 300, something like that, and they've actually expanded some. It used to be that books were smaller than this. I don't know if you have, but when I opened the store, books were not this size. Books were this size. And shelving reflected that. And then Barnes & Noble came along and said, if you will make the book taller, we can face it out and it will display better. And so you can see that if you look at early Sue Grafton's, for example, if you look at A through, I think it's F, they're all a 10 inch, I think it is, size. And then all of a sudden she went up to 12, because that was when this happened. And then it got to be for a while back then, this was in the late 80s, early 90s or whatever, that writer started to say that if they didn't have a bigger size book, they felt like second class writers, you know, that their books weren't important enough for it to go up. And so gradually we've gotten books this size and it becomes a more standard production. But the fun part is that Agatha Christie wanted to write a short book. She thought that 120 to 130 pages was the ideal size for one of her crime novels. And the reason is that they were so intricately plotted that she wanted somebody to sit down after dinner and be able to read her book before bed, because otherwise you might lose track of the story. That didn't work with signatures in books, because pages, a signature in a book, the pages that are in here, they come in 32s, the way the press works and so forth. And so her ideal size did not fit, and so there was a lot of waste paper in the signature. And so the publisher said, no, you have to write it bigger. This was Collins' crime. You have to write it longer so that we can write it to the end of the signature size. So her books went up to, I think it's like 156 pages or something like that. So actually, books really used to be short, literally short, and like that, if you look at older books. And then it really changed when Barnes & Noble came along and created these miles of shelves, and they had to fill them up, and they wanted books that would display better.
And they could fill
so
up.
That's why we wound up with this book. And now it's become more of an industry standard. But there are publishers who are deliberately shrinking books back. So you've seen some of them here. Jason Recollect's book, if any of you looked at it, Hidden Pictures, is and you'll love it. I was going to ask Patrick to get one to show you. He's actually, the illustrations in the book are the voice of the little girl. She draws, and they're not fancy illustrations. They're just like a kid would draw, you know. But as you move through the book and the pictures that this child has written, it's her voice and her story till you get to the end of it. But the book is back down to the smaller size.
And wouldn't that make sense for the publishers too, though, because it's saving them
yes.
on production costs?
Exactly. And so, I mean, I find it, I think the thing is they've tooled up. And now
yeah, and
it
all
will
the print
cost
again.
Them more money to, yeah, to yeah, tool yeah. back down. But some, and especially some of the more independent, the smaller publishers, you know, are in fact going back down again. So think about it. Do you want a really big book, or do you want a book you could read, you know, in a day? It depends on your mood. It depends on a whole lot of things. But I do find that this is still, to me, an anomaly.
Well, I think you can read The Self-Made Widow in a day if you just do nothing else but read The Self-Made Widow. That's
right.
Much, I could be wrong, but I think you can read it.
Right. So let's go back to Suburban Dicks. And I haven't mentioned that Fabian's book was nominated for an Edgar for Best First Novel. So that's a really great distinction. There's only 5 books published every year that get to make it into that category. What was it about Suburban New Jersey and Andy Stern, who is enormously pregnant and already has 4 kids and had to drop out of her life because she got pregnant in college and apparently
constantly thereafter.
Apparently Roe versus White hadn't intruded on her landscape where she had some reason for going through with it. What was so interesting to you about all that?
It really was a product of my surroundings. It was the world that I lived in and still live in to this day. But the book, the genesis of the original idea of the book was predicated on real events that were happening in my life. The house that Andy lives in the 2 books is the house I lived in from 1993 to 2001. It was new construction. It was a nice small U-shaped block, so it wasn't like 150 housing construction unit that was happening in the area I live in, which is West Windsor, Plainsboro, sister towns right near Princeton. A lot of farmland was sold and turned into housing development. So in the late 80s through the 90s, there was a large influx of people into the houses, including me. You know, my wife and I had a townhouse in another neighboring town, Lawrenceville, because she worked for the New Jersey state government, and I needed a way to get into Manhattan to work at Marvel, and that was the train station that's right near, right there in Princeton Junction train station, which is prevalent throughout the first book. And we had a gun club on the other side of the pond behind the house. The reason we loved that the development that was going up is because there was a pond there, and that pond was made by a farmer like 100 years earlier. He dammed a creek and he watered his potato fields with that pond, and now they were going to build 20 houses in a U-shaped block right there. And we got one of the lots that had backed up right into the pond, and it was really, really nice. Except occasionally there was outdoor shooting, and your regulars would come out 3 times a week, three different guys who shot regularly. So the gun club had been there for 50 years and maybe had about 10 West Windsor residents. The rest were all from residents from neighboring towns. And let the buyer beware, we should have known about it, but we didn't even hear the first gunshot until we were actually standing on a dirt pile as the skeleton frame of the house was going up at like 6 o'clock at night on a Tuesday when I got home from work early. We wanted to see how the house was going up, and we're standing on a dirt pile, my wife and I still remember to this day, and we heard the gunshots. And we looked at each other and said, "You can barely hear a thing, huh?" Because that's what the saleswoman had told us at the little trailer when we signed the $1,000 deposit contract, you know? And no, you could really hear the gun club. And then they were nice enough to occasionally send bullets our way. Not all the time, but once in a while, a bullet on the driveway, a bullet hit my neighbor's house.
Being on a golf course where they...
Except it's not golf balls, it's bullets. And we tried as a group, our entire block got together, we discussed it, we hired a lawyer, we went to the town council, and we tried to get them to stop outdoor shooting. Not indoor shooting, outdoor shooting. And we lost in the town council 5-4. And that was it. They were going to be allowed to continue shooting. And that was around 95, I think. And I thought to myself, I would love if something happened that ruined them, shut them down. Like, you find something out about them that they've done that is going to turn the community against them and they're going to have to shut down. Meanwhile, I had a friend at Marvel. I won't name his name, but I have a friend who said to me, you know, I know a guy who burns things. And he meant it, too. And I go, no, we're not going to burn down the gun club. I prefer my revenge to be fictional in nature. So I came up with the idea of a crime, a murder being discovered that the townies had committed 30 years earlier. And a woman who should have been an FBI profiler, but was now pregnant with her fourth kid at the time, I think I had in my brain. It is in the book now. I added to her misery. And the reason I wanted a pregnant female lead character is because it was the time in our lives where we were all of our friends, all of us the same age, all getting houses at the same time, getting married roughly the same time, having our first kids roughly the same time. So, you know, 6-8 couples, everyone having kids within 2 years of each other, you know? And one of the dilemmas facing my wife and all of my friends is, you know, career versus stay at home. What do I do with that struggle? And I thought, what an interesting conflict for a character to carry the weight, the burden of that story. You know, like the desire to do what she knows she was meant to do, which is solve crimes, versus the responsibility of caring and nurturing for a kid. And I wanted to make the husbands all clueless idiots because I just feel that was accurate. So that was the impetus. That was the genesis. And I thought, I need me in there, and I can't be Andy. Andy's an amalgam of multiple people from my life back then. I need me in there, so Kenny was me. And that brashness, that arrogance, that's me. But I was 31, 32 at the time, and I was one of the most successful comic book writers in the industry at that point, and I was that young, and I thought to myself, what the heck am I gonna do next? So I brought some of that insecurity and uncertainty to Kenny. He was successful in college, he got a Pulitzer Prize in college, now he's turning 30, and he's miserable, and he doesn't think he's ever going to get to do the next thing career-wise, and that was an absolute insecurity and concern that I had back then too. Because if you're here, if you get that high that quickly, that early, you know, there's not that much left but the fall, you know. So those were my two main characters, and I came up with the beginning, middle, and end of the story, the investigating a current crime that is a cover-up to an old crime, and then over 25 years it just gestated and percolated. The thrust of the story never changed, but a lot of the underlying foundation of the themes of the story evolved because I became more aware of the simmering cultural diversity and divide that was happening in my town. A huge influx of Asian residents, India, Pakistan, China, Korea, a lot of residents, immigrants coming in. And the demographics of the town changed quite a lot rapidly from the late 80s, early 90s to the tens, right? 60-70% Asian population in my town now. One of the reasons is because the school district is one of the best rated in New Jersey, and they wanted to go to that school district. You saw the first generation of home buyers who bought in the early 90s, all Caucasians, start to leave. And I watched all this happening, and I'm a tan American. I'm an immigrant to this country, but I grew up in New Jersey my entire life, so I'm this weird kind of on the outside, but on the inside as well. And I had the van full of kids from the soccer team because I was the coach of the team. My daughter played, and we had 7 kids in the car, and I'm driving to the game or from the game with 7 players because the older they get, the less the parents want to bother driving to travel soccer games. And they were 7 different cultural, identities. And one time I looked in my rearview mirror and I said, wow, holy crap. This is great. This is cool. I'm good with this. This is great. This is good for my kids. It's excellent. I didn't grow up with that, but there are people who look in the rearview mirror and say, this is scary. This isn't good. I don't like this. And they have stories to tell. In my particular case, I wanted them to be the bad guys. I wanted the story that I was telling about them to that they were the bad guys for having those feelings, for being afraid of the other, being scared of change. And that's the underlying foundation of Suburban Dicks, which is that fear of change in your life and that safety net you think you have for yourself. And I tried to reflect that through the fear my main characters have to move past the impediments that have been keeping them down. And in the second book, Kenny has moved past it in a lot of ways. He has reattained a level that he probably always should have had, and he's thriving and he's excited by it. Andrea has come to real terms with where she is and who she is. She knows she's going to do this as her future, solve crimes. But she has a little more patience now because she successfully did it in Suburban Dicks. So she has a little more patience that it's going to happen when it needs to happen, not necessarily when she forces it to happen.
So you haven't really described to us what Kenny's job is.
Kenny's a reporter. Kenny Lee in college discovered that the governor of New Jersey was doing some things he shouldn't have been doing, and then continued on that investigation as a college student, and eventually that got picked up by the Star Ledger, which is the largest paper in New Jersey, and he started working with the Star Ledger reporters. That led to the resignation of the governor of New Jersey. It tore down his whole administration, and Kenny and the other reporters won a Pulitzer Prize. So Kenny won a Pulitzer Prize at like 22 years old. The youngest person ever to win a Pulitzer Prize. I looked that up. Then he didn't get to take a job at Star Ledger because he thought he should be in New York working for a bigger paper, and he got a job at the Daily News. He got downsized 2 years later when the Daily News had a bunch of layoffs. He went back to the Star Ledger, and then he didn't file a decent story for over a year and a half, almost 2 years, so he ended up making up sources for a story that he was doing on a pharmaceutical company, and it got found out. So he was totally down and out. He got fired from the Star Ledger. His press pass was revoked, all these other problems that he had to deal with, and he's working for a weekly local suburban newspaper in the Princeton area when Suburban Dicks begins. But when Self-Made Widow begins, this is where the snake eats its own tail, so it's gonna get a little weird. Kenny has written a nonfiction book called Suburban Secrets, which is about the fictional events of Suburban Dicks. That book is going to be published by Putnam, and it's going to come out during the course of The Self-Made Widow. Netflix optioned Suburban Secrets for a documentary development, and Kenny is a part of that production. The way Netflix works is they have multiple limited liability corporations. This is even for their fiction shows. And there may be a reason I know that I can't talk about. He is working with this LLC called Muckrakers LLC. And so we introduce some new cast members, a supporting character from Suburban Dicks, who is his friend Jimmy, since he worked for Verizon, he had a cable locator device, and that's what they used to do certain things they did in the first book. I'm just learning still how to not give away stuff from previous books. And so Jimmy and Kenny commute into Manhattan every day. They work in the offices out of Union Square, and the mystery in this book is predicated on a husband dying of natural causes who's dying young. And everyone knows it's natural causes because he had a pre-existing heart condition, except Andy Stern, who thinks that her friend Molly killed her husband.
And that, I might add, is based upon a look. It's based upon
yes.
an expression on Molly's face
yes.
that she thought revealed that Molly had gotten away with something.
Yes,
I mean,
and that
no
that
actual evidence.
Andy admits it. Her methodology is intuitive and it's lucrative, ludicrous. It just doesn't make sense. But she connects things in very odd ways. She did so in the first book. She figured out that this crime that was the gas station attendant killed today was because someone was trying to cover up a crime that happened a long time ago. And that crime that happened a long time ago, she thought was going to mean they were going to find a buried body.
So she has an odd ability for pattern recognition.
Yes.
Right,
yes.
Which I have to say, any of you read Robert Pope's books at all, City of Windows, which is one of our favorite books here, and his guy, Lucas Page, if you recall, is mathematically, but he's a genius at pattern recognition. So he can look and see things that other people just goes by them. And as a result, there's a serial sniper at work, and nobody can figure out how to catch the serial sniper, but Lucas Page is able to deduce that.
So here's my problem, is I love writing characters that are smarter than me, but because I'm only so smart, I can only write them so much smarter than me. I can't go that extra step of intelligence because I can't go that extra step. So I figure Andy is like a good 20% smarter than me, but I can't figure out how to write her 40 or 50% smarter than me because I'm not smart enough to do that. It's very vexing. So I try to make her see things
right.
that others won't, and I try to have her see it before others do. So that at least then that way, whatever is driving her, 9 times out of 10 is solely internal to her. Others don't understand it.
How old is the baby? This is her fifth child.
And in the beginning of this book, it takes place 11 months after the end of Suburban Dicks. The baby's 11 months old. I can't give away the ending of Suburban Dicks, but because she's pregnant throughout the run of the book, you can assume that she will have a baby. So she does have the baby after the events of Suburban Dicks, and now I don't want to give away the gender, and I don't want to give away the name because I want it to be fun for readers to see it when they read it. The baby's 11 months old, so it's basically the totality of her investigation is usually with a kid slung around her arm.
The slightly unreal part is that anybody who's actually had a baby and gotten up to 11 months old is so sleep deprived, they're almost completely non-functional. I've just revisited that when we adopted the two puppies at 4 months old. I had totally forgotten how totally exhausting it is to have babies. You're just tired all the
She's
time.
She's exhausted all the time.
So.
A little less so though. I wanted to take a step back on her. I felt like after rereading Suburban Dicks and listening to readers' thoughts on it, I thought maybe I put my writing foot on her neck a little too hard. You know, I wanted to just take a step back and
she was kind of Wonder Woman,
but not happy and exhausted She's not necessarily happy in The Self-Made Widow, because I don't know if she'll ever be a happy person per se, but she's in a much more comfortable place right now. The family unit is kind of operating on better cylinders right now. A lot
just
of that
because
is because
some
she's
of the kids are
in
older.
A better place.
Yeah.
The kids are older, they can help more, and that makes a difference too. But for her, I think having the kid is easier than being pregnant is for her. And because she felt pregnancy was a trap for her.
But it's also an incredible physical toll. I mean, there are all kinds of studies that show that women who have a number of children very close together, it's a tremendous toll on your body. And so,
5 kids in 11 years.
That's my point. You know, it's time for her to stop. One of them needs to be
this
paying
attention
to contraception.
She's not going to have another kid.
Okay.
As far as we know.
But anyway, so, you know, so good for her that she has survived, you know, all of that and is still a functioning human being.
Yes, and now that because, like, her oldest, Ruth, is old enough to help her with the investigation now, so she can have Ruth do a few things that need to be done during the course of the investigation. That makes sense because they're trying to get information from the deceased non-murder victim's son, who is a classmate of Ruth's, so they're trying to find out what kind of tensions were in the marriage. So I wanted to bring Ruth up a little more because I really like the character, and I know where I want her to go. And she's at a point now where she is really curious and fascinated by who her mother is, because she finally looked at the Wikipedia page that she didn't even know existed about her mother, and thinks what my mother does is pretty amazing. But I'm not necessarily kosher on how she does it. So maybe there's a better way to do what she does is what, you know, that 12-year-old is, you know, is starting to think, which I like also. I like that dynamic.
So from all this, we can infer that there is another book coming?
No, we cannot infer that. Oh, maybe someone from Putnam is watching right now. Hi, guys. It was a two-book contract. I've written two books. We are in the business dance stage, where the agents and the publishers do a dance, and the writer sort of is sitting in the corner going, guys, I want to type. And Putnam hasn't said they want to do more, but they haven't said they don't want to do more. My agent doesn't want to make a deal that he doesn't think is on par with this deal, and I could care less about that, quite frankly. I say it publicly because I don't care. I just want to write. So. Right. So hopefully we will work things out, or it will be worked out that I'll get to do more, because I would love to do more. I certainly have more stories that I want to tell, and I want to track the growth of all the characters in the book through, you know, the next 10 years of their lives.
Okay. Well, that makes perfectly good sense. It is a shame we can't really talk much more about the story, because it's quite clever the way it all works out, but you'd be cross, right? Those of you here, if we did that. Any of you have questions that you'd like to ask? Patrick, are there any questions from the audience?
Yeah, there was a question from Mark, and you've talked maybe a little bit about this already, but he would like to know do you stay current on what's going on in comic book world? And
not,
do you have any favorites?
I'm not current, like I'm reading them as they come out anymore.
Yeah.
I read them in trade paperback form, and usually a year or two after they've come out. Favorites, I just in the last couple weeks, I downloaded a couple Ms. Marvel trade paperbacks. I'd read a whole bunch of them. The TV show just started on Disney Plus. And I had read the first few trade paperbacks of Ms. Marvel, and really, really enjoyed them tremendously. And now I just read two of the later ones that I hadn't gotten to, like volume 7 and 8 or something like that. And it's still an excellently done book. The G. Willow Wilson, the writer, along with a bunch of different artists, have done an excellent job of creating this character, whole cloth, who didn't exist before. She has a Spider-Man 1963 vibe to her, which is not easy to do. So I respect what they've done tremendously. I think the show is fantastic too. The girl who plays the Ms. Marvel character is her first acting job, and she's an absolute find for them. So yes, I would recommend Ms. Marvel to adults, to children, to teens, to anybody. I think it's really well done.
Is that it?
I'll keep checking.
Okay. Any of you have a question that you'd like to ask? Oh, sorry. There you are, Pat.
Yes. So back in the 90s, you and Scott Wilco were kind of one of the major creators of the multi-book character story arcs, like Executioner Song, for instance, one of my favorites, within the X-Men. I'm just curious, nowadays, do you feel like Marvel and DC are getting too caught up in these 20, 30 book
Well, I mean, the answer is anything that is successful for a publishing company, they will do to death, right? So if you do a crossover in 1985, Secret Wars, you know, and it's hugely successful for Marvel, you're going to have Secret Wars 2 a year later. And then you're going to, if X-Men does a crossover, then the publisher is going to ask for two crossovers because you got to fill those quarterly budget estimates. The X-Men stuff that we did, quite a lot of it was forced on us to do. It wasn't organic to our creative process. It was the company itself saying we need X amount of dollars in the budget, and our third quarter isn't going to be as good as we want it to be, so you're going to need to do a crossover in the third quarter. And we say, wait, we're doing a crossover already in the second quarter. You want us to do another one? And yes, if you look back then, you'll see that that happened. So what happens when the company starts selling less, which happened in the early aughts in terms of general sales, all went down, they find that doing these things increase their sales by 10-20% per book when you do that. I was writing a book for Marvel in the early aughts called Cable and Deadpool, which barely made its numbers. It sold like 35,000 copies. So that was not a high-end selling book, even by the standards of sales at that time. Every time I crossed over into one of their crossover storylines, the book sales went up 5,000 copies. Guess what? On the budget, that was enough to keep me from getting canceled. Because if I got two or three issues that cross over, the numbers amortize across the board over 12 months, and all of a sudden the numbers look a little better because you're adding those 15, 20 extra thousand copies for those three issues across what the average is for all 12. You know, and we were always under the threat of getting canceled. So anytime there was a crossover coming up, I was like, yeah, sure. I'll jump into the crossover. What is it? Oh, I don't know. Whatever. I'll do whatever I want, and we'll just put the crossover's logo on it. You know. So yeah, do they do it too much? Yes, they do it too much. But they feel they have no choice.
Gotcha. Hmm. So between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And for everyone though, for the creators you are, for the editors you are, even for the company itself you are, because the company also knows, although it never wants to admit it, that it is a snake eating its own tail when it does that.
So you and Greg Rucka, I can think of Brad Meltzer having crossed over into writing comics.
Well, Brad started as a novelist, and then he crossed over. Greg started as a comic writer, I think, then went to novelist.
Why do you think that so many comic book writers...
That's a good question. I don't know. Alex Segura also is a comic book writer who writes mysteries. Charles Soule has written... He hasn't written mysteries, and he's done a few novels. I don't know. My process is so completely, my story is so completely divorced from whatever they may have as their stories. You know, I wrote a book 25 years after I had the idea for a book. You know, so that's not comparable to Greg Rucka or to Alex Segura. You know. For me, it was a completely different reason, which we talked about before. So I had the mystery story idea, you know, while I was writing X-Men. So it wasn't a matter of gravitating towards it later. It was that's what it was to begin with. And I'm not a mystery writer, and I'm not a mystery reader, really. I have been much more so the last few years, but growing up, I wasn't that much of a mystery reader at all, you know? I read the classic stuff. I read Agatha Christie. You know, I can't even remember half of the things I had to read, mostly for college courses. But it wasn't my go-to genre.
But a good comic usually has good mystery
behind it. Well, yeah, that's yes. Almost any story can be claimed to have some mystery elements to it. It doesn't have to be a murder investigation. It doesn't have to be a whodunit or even a whydunit, which is what Self-Made Widow is more of. But every story generally has an answer that has to be uncovered, and the questions that have to be asked in the process of uncovering that answer. That's like the elemental foundation of a mystery story. You know?
I miss Greg Rucka. He was a terrific mystery writer, and then he just stopped.
He hasn't done, I don't know.
What was the name of his character, Patrick? Do you remember?
Atticus Kodiak.
That's it, Atticus Kodiak. I mean, they were fabulous. They were real thrillers. There were, what, four, I think? Something like that.
Six
altogether.
Six, and then Alpha and Bravo, I can't think. Those were a separate new series that he was writing.
King and Country, or something like that.
He did a standalone Queen and Country.
Queen and Country, okay.
But that was based on the comic book he did, I think.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah, it was a comic book first.
Yeah, I really, really liked it.
Charlie Houston and Dwayne Swierczynski, or
novelist first, comic writer second.
But who have kind of disappeared for the moment, anyway.
As novelists.
They'll be back, though, I think.
I don't want to hear that, because I'm going to disappear too then, and I don't want to disappear. I want to stay appeared.
You do. Great. So, anybody else have a question? Yes? No? Yeah.
What happened to the gun club? I feel like there's a big mystery there.
They're still there.
Okay.
We moved away, but they're still there. We sold our house in 2001 because my wife just couldn't take it anymore. That was enough. And we had really done everything to the house that we wanted to do. So it was a grinding point of contention in my life. But the good news for me is that we sold it to our neighbor right down the block, who didn't have much of a backyard because the woods were right up against the house. And they had three boys, and they wanted what we had done, the pool and the play set and the deck, and they wanted that. So they knew full well what the gun club was, because
the stray bullet didn't really bother them.
Apparently not, and because they still live there now. They still live there to this day. I do know that they changed the direction of the berms. They did have to do that, and they did.
They did
all that quietly, and that was the town council and the police probably saying, "We have to do something because you're sending bullets their way.
Right.
We can't cover." Then they were covering it up. They were not talking about it. Then a cop came to my house. There was a bullet on my driveway with my kid's bicycle right next to it. That I went out to get the newspaper. The kid had left a bike outside, and the bullet was right there. And the cop who showed up at my house, because we call the police, walks up to it, picks it up, and starts to walk away. And I said, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "You don't even want to know what angle it came from. You're not taking a picture of it. You're not doing anything." He's like, "We'll figure it out." I was like, "Come on," because the cops were shooting at the gun at the indoor range. That was their testing practice spot. And I was like, "Yeah." So yeah, we got
that. Would have been a great kind of still life photo if you could have captured it, the bike and the.
And I should have,
yeah.
No, I was just so, no, I didn't even think of that. I should have thought of that, but quite honestly, all I was thinking of, this could have been my kid on her bicycle with her training wheels on the driveway when a bullet came over, you know? New Jersey. America, actually. Bullets in the backyard, no problem. We'll just pick up the bullets.
Yeah, that's an extreme, but there are lots of cases where people move in a new development into something that already exists and then complain bitterly about it. I remember the Phoenix Open has been forever at the golf club just on the other side of Frank Lloyd Wright Parkway, whatever it is. Anyway, the canal. And I remember reading an outraged letter in the Republic that a couple who retired and moved out and bought a condominium and bought it in the fall. And they just couldn't believe the traffic and the parking problems, and they felt that they were there now and said that the Phoenix Open should be canceled because they'd moved in.
And
I have a nephew that has a home down in Chandler and knew all along that the city dump was right proximate to where this development was going to go. And so the development went in, the people moved in the development, and then they tried to cancel the city dump. So, you know,
always.
Your case is dangerous.
My case is dangerous, and I fully admit always that it is let the buyer beware. We should have done more research before we signed that deposit, you know what I mean? But you're 31 years old, your wife is 29 years old, and you're buying your first house, and you're being told that there's five other people that want to buy that lot, and if you don't sign right now and put your $1,000 check down, you're not going to get it. And meanwhile, she has disclosed that there's a gun club on the other side, but she doesn't tell you how close it is. All she says is you can't hear a thing, and it's months.
You didn't have an ethical realtor, so that's part of the problem. But I do think that there is a constant conflict between development
always
and what already exists. That's really true of wildlife as well. We have a coyote wandering through our neighborhood at the moment, and it's been there forever. The neighbors are outraged because the coyote is there, and I'm on the side of the coyote. It's not okay with me to ding the coyote because everybody wanted to move in.
Yeah, it's like people where I am complaining about the deer because we have a lot of deer, right. And it's like, well, the deer have been running these tracks for hundreds of years. That's their cyclical feeding pattern.
Right.
So they'll get to your house area every couple months because they're going in a pattern, right? You know, look, if you can write an Edgar Award nominated book about the deer and their feeding pattern, go for it. I just decided to use the gun club instead. It worked out better.
Good choice. I like that. Anybody else? Yeah.
So you said you want to write a third book. Do you have an idea of where you want to go with it yet?
I got an outline for the whole thing already. I have actually the first book I keep talking about, you know, 1995, but quite frankly, this book's was not that long afterwards, and it's also predicated on real life, and it was a very close friend of mine passing away at 43 of a heart attack, and he had a pre-existing heart condition that he didn't even know about, and he had just recently married his second marriage. They'd just been married less than a year earlier, I think it was, and it was born of dark humor that happens when you have a tragedy in your life, and I think it was at his wake where one of my friends, because he worked at Marvel Comics, the man who passed away, one of my friends said, "Oh, I don't want to say the wife's name, so I'll make up a name." It's like, "What if Linda did it?" And then we all went, "Oh, like, you know," and we were just venting, but I left thinking, wait, what if Linda did it? What's the story? What if the wife killed the husband?
She really did it, yeah.
Yeah, what if the wife killed the husband, but he died of natural causes? And that's literally what the story is. He did die of natural causes, but, you know. So yes, I have six total books and the reason I try to think of them thematically. So my mystery is basically the overlying car driving on the road, but the themes of the book are the road itself. And each of the next three that I have, four that I have, already have preset themes in my brain that the story revolves around. The third one will be parenthood in suburbia. The fourth one would be the pressures parents put on children for education and athletics in suburbia. You know, it's all set in New Jersey, and it's all also the reality of everything around me. Like I mentioned earlier, we're in a very highly competitive school district. A lot of our taxpayer dollar goes to the school district, and my kids went through that school district, and I saw the pressures that they faced. With what the expectations were for them being in such a highly competitive school district. So, there's a story to be told there, too, you know. Yes, they're there. The third one's actually really, it is broken down already by chapter. The fourth one, I know what my benchmarks are. The fifth one, I haven't even started yet. Give me a break. I haven't even got a contract for a third one. All this pressure I feel now, but I would like to write them. I hope I get to. I hope it's for Putnam, but I don't know. Last year, cicadas came out for the first time in 17 years. They came out in my area. I have a video. If you want, I'll play for you later. It sounded like every phaser from 1967 Star Trek going off at the same time. That's how loud the cicadas were. And I thought, what if there's a family that kills every 17 years? So there's your sixth book. Meet the Cicadas. It's even got a title.
You definitely have a mind for crime, no kidding. Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, I wanted the books to have quirky titles.
That's a good sitcom. Meet the Cicadas.
Meet the Cicadas. Oh, yeah. I got the cover in my brain already, like just the little family
giant
of four,
bug.
But they're cicadas.
Yeah.
They're bugs.
I love it. That sounds grand. Who can resist that? Come on, Mark.
Come on, Putnam. Mm-hmm. Wow. There's plenty of publishers out there. Look at me. I'm getting all cocky right now. There's lots of publishers out there. You never know.
Sure enough. Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us this evening. It's pretty been entertaining and very informative. I love going into a world that I don't know much about, which is the comic world. And I don't think I, well, why would I have told you? Because we have never talked before. But when I was a kid in Winnetka, Illinois, I lived across the street. My grandparents lived across the street from the guy that wrote Dick Tracy.
Oh,
just and so we used to get sneak previews of, do you remember the two-way wrist radio? It was a huge deal. We got to, you know, so we were constantly being updated on Dick Tracy technology because it was really quite ahead of its time.
It was.
If you, you know, look back on it, he had some terrific ideas that subsequently have been implemented to now are updated.
Else, yeah.
But nonetheless, you know, in like 1946 or 47, they were a really big deal.
It was the most, it was one of the most popular comic strips in the
it
country
was.
For years.
Yep.
Years.
Yep. Yeah. So,
that's,
you know,
cool.
There's a, yeah. And do you remember the little big books?
Yeah.
Did you ever, you know,
in
so
the 60s,
Flash
I got.
Flash Gordon and the Emperor Ming was my personal favorite title when I was young because they had these really cool illustrations of the Emperor Ming on the planet, whatever it was. And his daughter, Princess Aurelia. See, I've never forgotten it. It was like, you know.
From Flash Gordon,
75
right?
years ago that I read this stuff. Yeah. But Flash Gordon, in that particular book, Flash Gordon and the Emperor Ming.
And the little.
And the space hero and magically, you know, got to zip around the universe and get to the planet Ming where he got to save the day. It was just, you know.
And you also managed to wrap it all back around again because we're talking about little big books.
Exactly. Yep.
So
they, really
they were
little.
This big and
they
then this thick.
They were really thick, but they were, yeah, they were,
yeah.
What were they, like? Four,
they were like 4 inches by
four,
three
four by
or something.
Yeah, or something. Four
they,
by, they
I had
square.
A, I had
no,
like four or five of them
actually,
when I was little.
I think,
yeah.
So I love those books.
They were
you
thick
could
too.
Carry them around, you know, because you could. I mean, yeah, right. They fit in your pocket, whatever. Well, not terribly because they were so thick. But anyway, you know.
I think I threw a disc out of my back because I might have had one in my back pocket while I was riding my bicycle.
So, you know what, all things go around and come around in publishing, so we'll probably see somebody republishing the little big books once again. And we are seeing a lot of books beginning to shrink back from this 12-inch size back to 10. And it's interesting that the reason for something like that change would be a retailer, because Barnes & Noble was the big retailer in the 90s when all this got, and that was before Amazon. Now Amazon doesn't care how big your book is, right?
Yeah.
They don't care. I don't care if it's this tall or that tall because it's a whole different deal. They are not doing shelves, they have warehouses, the whole bit. And so the pressure to do it this way has largely disappeared.
Yeah.
But I really do think that it's the production has been scaled to this and to change
it is going to be hard.
Would be expensive.
And companies, industries as a whole, not even individual companies, but industries are like giant shipping containers from China. It's going to be really slow to move
but
them
and
change.
But you know
what
may make the difference is that the cost of paper has gone up
so
dramatically,
much.
And it's
yeah.
harder to get press time and all, that the economics of production may outweigh the economics
yeah.
of making the change. So we may see it go back. So you may be the only people who will actually know why books are going to shrink again. Thanks for coming here. I love it. It's an education. Anyway, thanks very much for joining us. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.